Penguin Random House Audio presents 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, by Elliot Ackerman and Admiral James Stavridis. Read for you by Emily Wu Zeller, PJ Oakland, Vikas Adam, Dion Graham, and Fyodor Chin. Note to listeners, tune in at the end of this program for an exclusive interview with author Admiral James Stavridis. For there is no folly of the beast of the earth which is not infinitely outdone by the madness of men. Herman Melville. 1. The Wenrei Incident. 1447, March 12th, 2034. GMT plus 8. South China Sea. It surprised her still. Even after 24 years, the way from horizon to horizon the vast expanse of ocean could in an instant turn completely calm, taut as a linen pulled across a table. She imagined that if a single needle were dropped from a height, it would slip through all the fathoms of water to the seabed, where, undisturbed by any current, it would rest on its point. How many times over her career had she stood as she did now, on the bridge of a ship, observing this miracle of stillness? 1,000 times? 2,000? On a recent sleepless night, she had studied her logbooks and totaled up all the days she had spent traversing the deep ocean, out of sight of land. It added up to nearly 9 years. Her memory darted back and forth across those long years, to her watch-standing days as an ensign on the wood-slatted decks of a minesweeper with its bronchial diesel engines, to her mid-career hiatus and special warfare spent in the brown waters of the world. To this day, with these 3 sleek Arleigh Burke-class destroyers under her command, cutting a south-by-southwest wake at 18 knots under a relentless and uncaring sun. Her small flotilla was 12 nautical miles off Mischief Reef, in the long-disputed Spratly Islands on a euphemistically titled Freedom of Navigation Patrol. She hated that term. Like so much in military life, it was designed to belie the truth of their mission, which was a provocation, plain and simple. These were indisputably international waters, at least according to established conventions of maritime law. But the People's Republic of China claimed them as territorial seas. Passing through the much-disputed Spratlys with her flotilla was the legal equivalent of driving donuts into your neighbor's prized front lawn after he moves his fence a little too far onto your property. And the Chinese had been doing that for decades now, moving the fence a little further, and a little further still, until they would claim the entire South Pacific. So, time to donut drive their yard. Maybe we should simply call it that, she thought, the hint of a smirk falling across her carefully curated demeanor. Let's call it a donut drive instead of a Freedom of Navigation patrol. At least then my sailors would understand what the hell we're doing out here. She glanced behind her, toward the fantail of her flagship, the John Paul Jones. Extending in its wake, arrayed in a line of battle over the flat horizon were her other 2 destroyers, the Carl Levin and Chung Hoon. She was the Commodore, in charge of these 3 warships, as well as another 4 still back in their home port of San Diego. She stood at the pinnacle of her career, and when she stared off in the direction of her other ships, searching for them in the wake of her flagship, she couldn't help but see herself out there, as clearly as if she were standing on that tabletop of perfectly calm ocean, appearing and disappearing into the shimmer. Herself as she once was. The youthful Ensign Sarah Hunt. And then herself as she was now. The older, wiser Captain Sarah Hunt, Commodore of Destroyer Squadron 21. Solomon's Onward. Their motto since the Second World War. Rampant Lions. The name they gave themselves. On the deck plates of her 7 ships, she was affectionately known as the Lion Queen. She stood for a while, staring pensively into the ship's wake, finding and losing an image of herself in the water. She'd been given the news from the medical board yesterday, right before she'd pulled in all lines and sailed out of Yokosuka Naval Station. The envelope was tucked in her pocket. The thought of the paper made her left leg ache, right where the bone had set poorly. The ache followed by a predictable lightning bolt of pins and needles that began at the base of her spine. The old injury had finally caught up with her. The medical board had had its say. This would be the Lion Queen's last voyage. Hunt couldn't quite believe it. The light changed suddenly, almost imperceptibly. Hunt observed an oblong shadow passing across the smooth mantle of the sea, whose surface was now interrupted by a flicker of wind, forming into a ripple. She glanced above her, to where a thin cloud, the only one in the sky, made its transit. Then the cloud vanished, dissolving into mist, as it failed to make passage beyond the relentless late winter sun. The water grew perfectly still once again. Her thoughts were interrupted by the hollow clatter of steps, quickly and lightly making their way up the ladder behind her. Hunt checked her watch. The ship's captain, Commander Jane Morris, was, as usual, running behind schedule.
10:51, March 12th, 2034. GMT plus 4:30. Strait of Hormuz. Major Chris Wedge Mitchell hardly ever felt it. His father had felt it a bit more than him. Like that one time the FLIR on his F-A-18 Hornet had failed and he'd pickle-barreled two GBU-38s, danger close for a platoon of grunts in Ramadi, using nothing but a handheld GPS and a map. Pop, his grandfather, had felt it more than them both. When for five exhausting days, he dropped Snake and Nape with nothing more than an optical sight on treetop passes during Tet, where he dusted in so low, the flames had blistered the fuselage of his A4 Skyhawk. Pop-Pop, his great-grandfather, had felt it most of all, patrolling the South Pacific for Japanese Zeros with VMF-214, the famed Black Sheep Squadron, led by the hard-drinking, harder-fighting, five-time Marine Corps ace, Major Gregory Pappy Boyington. This elusive it, which had held four generations of Mitchells in its thrall, was the sensation of flying by the seat of your pants, on pure instinct alone. Back when I flew with Pappy, and we'd be on patrol, it wasn't all whiz-bang like you have it now. No targeting computers, no autopilot. It was just your skill, your controls, and your luck. We'd mark our gun sights on the canopy with a grease pencil, and off we'd fly. And when you flew with Pappy, you learned pretty quick to watch your horizon. You'd watch it close, but you'd also watch Pappy. When he'd toss his cigarette out of the cockpit and slam his canopy shut, you knew he meant business, and you were about to tangle with a flight of Zeros. The last time Wedge had heard that little speech from his great-grandfather, he'd been 6 years old. The sharp-eyed pilot had only the slightest tremor in his voice, despite his 90-plus years. And now, as the clear sun caught light on his canopy, Wedge could hear the words as distinctly as if his great-grandfather were riding along as his backseater. Except the F-35E Lightning he flew only had a single seat. This was but one of the many gripes Wedge had with the fighter he was piloting so close to Iranian airspace that he was literally dancing his starboard wing along the border. Not that the maneuver was hard. In fact, flying with such precision took no skill at all. The flight plan had been inputted into the F-35's onboard navigation computer. Wedge didn't have to do a thing. The plane flew itself. He merely watched the controls, admired the view out his canopy, and listened to the ghost of his great-grandfather taunting him from a non-existent backseat. Jammed behind his headrest was an auxiliary battery unit whose hum seemed impossibly loud, even over the F-35's turbofan engine. This battery, about the size of a shoebox, powered the latest upgrade to the fighter's suite of stealth technologies. Wedge hadn't been told much about the addition, only that it was some kind of an electromagnetic disruptor. Before he'd been briefed on his mission, he'd caught two civilian Lockheed contractors tampering with his plane below decks and had alerted the sergeant-at-arms, who himself had no record of any civilians on the manifest of the George H.W. Bush. This had resulted in a call to the ship's captain, who eventually resolved the confusion. Due to the sensitivity of the technology being installed, the presence of these contractors was itself highly classified. Ultimately, it proved a messy way for Wedge to learn about his mission. But aside from that initial hiccup, every other part of the flight plan had proceeded smoothly. Maybe too smoothly, which was the problem. Wedge was hopelessly bored. He glanced below to the Strait of Hormuz, that militarized sliver of turquoise that separated the Arabian Peninsula from Persia. He checked his watch, a Breitling chronometer with built-in compass and altimeter his father had worn during strafing runs over Marja 25 years before. He trusted the watch more than his onboard computer. Both said that he was 43 seconds out from a 6-degree eastward course adjustment that would take him into Iranian airspace. At which point, so long as the little humming box behind his head did its job, he would vanish completely. It would be a neat trick. It almost seemed like a prank that he'd been entrusted with such a high-tech mission. His buddies in the squadron had always joked that he should have been born in an earlier time. That's how he'd gotten his call sign, Wedge. The world's first and simplest tool. Time for his 6-degree turn. He switched off the autopilot. He knew there'd be hell to pay for flying throttle and stick, but he'd deal with that when he got back to the bush. He wanted to feel it. If only for a second, and if only for once in his life. It would be worth the ass-chewing. And so, with a bunch of noise behind his head, he banked into Iranian airspace.
1458, March 12, 2034, GMT plus 8, South China Sea. You wanted to see me, Commodore? Commander Jane Morris, captain of the John Paul Jones, seemed tired. Too tired to apologize for being almost 15 minutes late to her meeting with Hunt, who understood the strain Morris was under. Hunt understood that strain because she herself had felt it on occasions too countless to number. It was the strain of getting a ship underway, the absolute accountability for nearly 400 sailors, and the lack of sleep as the captain was summoned again and again to the bridge as the ship maneuvered through the seemingly endless fishing fleets in the South China Sea. The argument could be made that Hunt was under that strain three times over, based on the scope of her command. But both Hunt and Morris knew that the command of a flotilla was command by delegation, while the command of a ship was pure command. In the end, you and you alone are responsible for everything your ship does or fails to do. A simple lesson they'd both been taught as midshipmen at Annapolis. Hunt fished out two cigars from her cargo pocket. "And what are those?" asked Morris. "An apology," said Hunt. "They're Cubans. My dad used to buy them from the Marines at Gitmo. It's not as much fun now that they're legal, but still, they're pretty good." Morris was a devout Christian, quietly evangelical, and Hunt hadn't been sure whether or not she'd partake, so she was pleased when Morris took the cigar and came up alongside her on the bridge wing for a light. "An apology?" asked Morris. "What for?" She dipped the tip of the cigar into the flame made by Hunt's Zippo, which was engraved with one of those cigar-chomping, submachine-gun-toting bullfrogs commonly tattooed onto the chests and shoulders of Navy SEALs, or in the case of Hunt's father, etched onto the lighter he'd passed down to his only child. "I imagine you weren't thrilled to learn that I'd picked the John Paul Jones for my flagship." Hunt had lit her cigar as well, and as their ship held its course, the smoke was carried off behind them. "I wouldn't want you to think this choice was a rebuke," she continued, "particularly as the only other female in command. I wouldn't want you to think that I was trying to babysit you by situating my flag here." Hunt instinctively glanced up at the mast, at her Commodore's command pennant.
"Permission to speak freely?"
"Come on, Jane. Cut the shit. You're not a plebe. This isn't Bancroft Hall."
"Okay, ma'am," began Morris. "I never thought any of that. Wouldn't have even occurred to me. You've got 3 good ships with 3 good crews. You need to put yourself somewhere. Actually, my crew was pretty jazzed to hear that we'd have the Lion Queen herself on board."
"Could be worse," said Hunt. "If I were a man, you'd be stuck with the Lion King." Morris laughed. "And if I were the Lion King," deadpanned Hunt, "that'd make you Zazu." Then Hunt smiled, that wide-open smile that had always endeared her to her subordinates. Which led Morris to say a little more, maybe more than she would have in the normal course.
"If we were 2 men, and the Levin and Hoon were skippered by 2 women, do you think we'd be having this conversation?"
Morris allowed the beat of silence between them to serve as the answer. "You're right," said Hunt, taking another pull on her Cuban as she leaned on the deck railing and stared out toward the horizon, across the still impossibly calm ocean.
"How's your leg holding up?" asked Morris.
Hunt reached down to her thigh.
"It's as good as it'll ever be," she said.
She didn't touch the break in her femur, the one she'd suffered a decade before during a training jump gone bad. A faulty parachute had ended her tenure as one of the first women in the SEALs and nearly ended her life. Instead, she fingered the letter from the medical board resting in her pocket. They'd smoked their short cigars nearly down to the nubs when Morris spotted something on the starboard horizon.
"You see that smoke?" she said.
The 2 naval officers pitched their cigars over the side for a clearer view. It was a small ship, steaming slowly or perhaps even drifting. Morris ducked into the bridge and returned to the observation deck with 2 pairs of binoculars, 1 for each of them. They could see it clearly now, a trawler about 70 feet long, built low amidships to recover its fishing nets, with a high-built prow designed to crest storm surge. Smoke billowed from the aft part of the ship, where the navigation bridge was set behind the nets and cranes. Great, dense, dark clouds of it, interspersed with orange flames. There was a commotion on deck as the crew of maybe a dozen struggled to contain the blaze. The flotilla had rehearsed what to do in the event they came across a ship in duress. First, they would check to see if other vessels were coming to render assistance. If not, they would amplify any distress signals and facilitate finding help. What they wouldn't do, or would do only as an absolute last resort, was divert from their own freedom of navigation patrol to provide that assistance themselves.
"Did you catch the ship's nationality?" asked Hunt.
Inwardly, she began running through a decision tree of her options. Morris said no. There wasn't a flag flying either fore or aft. Then she stepped back into the bridge and asked the officer of the deck, a beef-fed lieutenant junior grade with a sweep of sandy blonde hair, whether or not a distress signal had come in over the last hour. The officer of the deck reviewed the bridge log, checked with the Combat Information Center, the central nervous system of the ship's sensors and communications complex a couple of decks below, and concluded that no distress signal had been issued. Before Morris could dispatch such a signal on the trawler's behalf, Hunt stepped onto the bridge and stopped her.
"We're diverting to render assistance," ordered Hunt. "Diverting?"
Morris's question escaped her reflexively, almost accidentally, as every head on the bridge swiveled toward the Commodore, who knew as well as the crew that lingering in these waters dramatically increased the odds of a confrontation with a naval vessel from the People's Liberation Army. The crew was already at a modified general quarters, well-trained and ready, the atmosphere one of grim anticipation.
"We've got a ship in duress that's sailing without a flag and that hasn't sent out a distress signal," said Hunt. "Let's take a closer look, Jane. And let's go to full general quarters.
Something doesn't add up.
Crisply, Morris issued those orders to the crew, as if they were the chorus to a song she'd rehearsed to herself for years, but up to this moment had never had the opportunity to perform. Sailors sprang into motion on every deck of the vessel, quickly donning flash gear, strapping on gas masks and inflatable life jackets, locking down the warship's many hatches, spinning up the full combat suite, to include energizing the stealth apparatus that would cloak the ship's radar and infrared signatures. While the John Paul Jones changed course and closed in on the incapacitated trawler, its sister ships, the Levin and Hoon, remained on course and speed for the Freedom of Navigation mission. The distance between them and the flagship began to open. Hunt then disappeared back to her stateroom, to where she would send out the encrypted dispatch to 7th Fleet headquarters in Yokosuka. Their plans had changed.
0447, March 12th, 2034. GMT-4. Washington, D.C. Dr. Sandeep Sandy Chaudhry, the Deputy National Security Advisor, hated the second and fourth Mondays of every month. These were the days, according to his custody agreement, that his six-year-old daughter, Ashni, returned to her mother. What often complicated matters was that the handoff didn't technically occur until the end of school, which left him responsible for any unforeseen childcare issues that might arise, such as a snow day. And on this particular Monday morning, a snow day in which he was scheduled to be in the White House Situation Room monitoring progress on a particularly sensitive test flight over the Strait of Hormuz, he had resorted to calling his own mother, the formidable Lakshmi Chaudhry, to come to his Logan Circle apartment. She had arrived before the sun had even risen in order to watch Ashni. "Don't forget my one condition," she'd reminded her son as he tightened his tie around the collar that was too loose for his thin neck. Heading out into the slushy pre-dawn, he paused at the door. "I won't forget," he told her. "And I'll be back by the time Ashni's picked up." He had to be. His mother's one condition was that she not be inflicted with the sight of Sandy's ex-wife, Samantha, a transplant from Texas's Gulf Coast whom Lakshmi haughtily called provincial. She disliked her the moment she had set eyes on her skinny frame and pageboy blonde haircut. "A poor man's Ellen DeGeneres," Lakshmi had once said in a pique, having to remind her son about the old-time television show host whose appeal she'd never understood. If being single and reliant upon his mother at 44 was somewhat humiliating, the ego blow was diminished when he removed his White House all-access badge from his briefcase. He flashed it to the uniformed Secret Service agent at the Northwest Gate while a couple of early morning joggers on Pennsylvania Avenue glanced in his direction, wondering if they should know who he was. It was only in the last 18 months, since he'd taken up his posting in the West Wing, that his mother had finally begun to correct people when they assumed that her son, Dr. Chaudhry, was a medical doctor. His mother had asked to visit his office several times, but he'd kept her at bay. The idea of an office in the West Wing was far more glamorous than the reality. A desk and a chair jammed against a basement wall in a general crush of staff. He sat at his desk, enjoying the rare quiet of the empty room. No one else had made it through the 2 inches of snow that had paralyzed the capital city. Chaudhry rooted around one of his drawers, scrounged up a badly crushed but still edible energy bar, and took it, a cup of coffee, and a briefing binder through the heavy soundproof doors into the Situation Room. A seat with a built-in work terminal had been left for him at the head of the conference table. He logged in. At the far end of the room was an LED screen with a map displaying the disposition of U.S. military forces abroad, to include an encrypted video teleconference link with each of the major combatant commands, Southern, Central, Northern, and the rest. He focused on the Indo-Pacific Command, the largest and most important, responsible for nearly 40% of the Earth's surface, though much of it was ocean. The briefer was Rear Admiral John T. Hendrickson, a nuclear submariner with whom Chaudhry had a passing familiarity, though they'd yet to work together directly. The admiral was flanked by two junior officers, a man and a woman, each significantly taller than him. The admiral and Chaudhry had been contemporaries in the doctoral program at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy 15 years before. That didn't mean they'd been friends. In fact, they'd only overlapped by a single year, but Chaudhry knew Hendrickson by reputation. At a hair over 5 feet 5 inches tall, Hendrickson was conspicuous in his shortness. His compact size made it seem as though he were born to fit into submarines, and his quirky, deeply analytic mind seemed equally customized for that strange brand of naval service. Hendrickson had finished his doctorate in a record-breaking 3 years, as opposed to Chaudhry's 7, and during that time, he'd led the Fletcher softball team to a hat trick of intramural championships in the Boston area, earning the nickname Bunt. Chaudhry nearly called Hendrickson by that old nickname, but he thought better of it. It was a moment for deference to official roles. The screen in front of them was littered with forward-deployed military units. An amphibious-ready group in the Aegean, a carrier battle group in the Western Pacific, two nuclear submarines under what remained of the Arctic ice, the concentric rings of armored formations fanned out from west to east in Central Europe as they had been for nearly 100 years to ward off Russian aggression. Hendrickson quickly homed in on two critical events underway. One long planned, the other developing, as Hendrickson put it. The planned event was the testing of a new electromagnetic disruptor within the F-35's suite of stealth technology. This test was now in progress and would play out over the next several hours. The fighter had been launched from a Marine squadron off the George H.W. Bush in the Arabian Gulf. Hendrickson glanced down at his watch.
"The pilot's been dark in Iranian airspace for the last 4 minutes."
He went into a long, top-secret, and dizzyingly expository paragraph on the nature of the electromagnetic disruption, which was occurring at that very moment, soothing the Iranian air defenses to sleep. Within the first few sentences, Chaudhry was lost. He had never been detail-oriented, particularly when those details were technical in nature. This was why he'd found his way into politics after graduate school. This was also why Hendrickson, brilliant though he was, did technically work for Chaudhry. As a political appointee on the National Security Council staff, Chaudhry outranked him, though this was a point few military officers in the White House would publicly concede to their civilian masters. Chaudhry's genius, while not technical, was an intuitive understanding of how to make the best out of any bad situation. He'd gotten his political start working in the one-term Pence presidency. Who could say he wasn't a survivor?
"The second situation is developing," continued Hendrickson. "The John Paul Jones Command Group, a three-ship surface action group, has diverted the flagship from its Freedom of Navigation patrol nearby the Spratly Islands to investigate a vessel in duress."
"What kind of vessel?" asked Chaudhry.
He was leaning back in the leather executive chair at the head of the conference table, the same chair that the president sat in when she used the room. Chaudhry was munching the end of his energy bar in a particularly non-presidential fashion.
"We don't know," answered Hendrickson. "We're waiting on an update from the 7th Fleet."
Even though Chaudhry couldn't follow the particulars of the F-35's stealth disruption, he did know that having a $2 billion Arleigh Burke guided missile destroyer playing rescue tugboat to a mystery ship in waters claimed by the Chinese had the potential to undermine his morning. And splitting up the surface action group didn't seem like the best idea.
"This doesn't sound good, Bunt. Who is the on-scene commander?"
Hendrickson shot a glance back at Chaudhry, who recognized the slight provocation he was making by using the old nickname. The two junior staffers exchanged an apprehensive look. Hendrickson chose to ignore it.
"I know the Commodore," he said. "Captain Sarah Hunt. She's extremely capable, top of her class at everything."
"So?"
asked Chaudhry.
So, we'd be prudent to cut her a little slack.
1528, March 12th, 2034, GMT plus 8, South China Sea. Once the order to render aid was given, the crew of the John Paul Jones worked quickly. Two ribs launched off the fantail and pulled alongside the burning trawler. The stocky blonde lieutenant junior grade had been placed in charge of this tiny flotilla of inflatable boats, while Hunt and Morris observed from the bridge, listening to the updates he sent over his handheld radio, with all the baritone hysteria of plays being called at the line of scrimmage. Both senior officers forgave his novice lack of calm. He was putting out a fire with two pumps and two hoses in hostile waters. Hostile, but completely calm. Rigid as a pane of glass as the drama of the fire and the trawler played out a couple of hundred yards off the bridge. Hunt found herself staring wistfully at the water, wondering again if perhaps this might be her last time seeing such a sea, or at least seeing it from the command of a naval vessel. After a moment's thought, she told the officer of the deck to send a signal to her other two destroyers to break off the Freedom of Navigation patrol and divert on scene. Better to have a bit more firepower in close. The Levin and Hoon reversed course and increased speed, and in a few minutes they had taken up positions around the John Paul Jones, sailing in a protective orbit as the flagship continued a dead slow approach toward the trawler. Soon, the last of the flames had been extinguished, and the young lieutenant junior grade gave a triumphant announcement over the radio, to which both Hunt and Morris volunteered some quick congratulations, followed by instructions for him to board and assess the extent of the damages. An order that he followed. Or at least tried to follow. The crew of the trawler met the first boarding party at the gunwales with angry, desperate shouts. One went so far as to swing a grapple at a bosun's head. Watching this struggle from the bridge of the John Paul Jones, Hunt wondered why the crew of a burning ship would so stridently resist help. Between radio transmissions, in which she encouraged a general de-escalation, she could overhear the trawler's crew, who spoke in what sounded like Mandarin.
"Ma'am, I suggest we cut them loose," Morris eventually offered. "They don't seem to want any more help."
"I can see that, Jane," responded Hunt. "But the question is, why not?" She could observe the boarding party and the crew of the trawler gesticulating wildly at one another. Why this resistance? Hunt saw Morris's point. With each passing minute, her command became increasingly vulnerable to intercept by a People's Liberation Army naval patrol, which would undermine their mission. But wasn't this their mission as well? To keep these waters safe and navigable? 10, maybe even 5 years before, the threat level had been lower. Back then, most of the Cold War treaties had remained intact. Those old systems had eroded, however. And Sarah Hunt, gazing out at this trawler with its defiant crew, had an instinct that this small fishing vessel represented a threat.
"Commander Morris," said Hunt gravely, "pull your ship alongside that trawler. If we can't board her from the ribs, we'll board her from here."
Morris immediately objected to the order, offering a predictable list of concerns. First, the time it would take would further expose them to a potential confrontation with a hostile naval patrol. Second, placing the John Paul Jones alongside the trawler would put their own ship at undue risk.
"We don't know what's on board," cautioned Morris.
Hunt listened patiently. She could feel Morris's crew going about their tasks on the bridge, trying to ignore these two senior-most officers as they had their disagreement. Then Hunt repeated the order. Morris complied. As the John Paul Jones came astride the trawler, Hunt could now see its name, Wenrui, and its home port, Quanzhou, a provincial-level anchorage astride the Taiwan Strait. Her crew shot grapples over the trawler's gunwales, which allowed them to affix steel tow cables to its side. Lashed together, the two ships cut through the water in tandem like a motorcycle with an unruly sidecar. The danger of this maneuver was obvious to everyone on the bridge. They went about their tasks with a glum air of silent sailor disapproval,
all thinking their Commodore was risking the ship unnecessarily for a bunch of agitated Chinese fishermen. No one voiced their collective wish that their Commodore let her hunch go by the boards and return them to safer waters. Sensing the discontent, Hunt announced that she was heading below decks. Heads snapped around.
"Where to, ma'am?"
Morris said by way of protest, seemingly indignant that her commander would abandon her in such a precarious position.
"To the Wenrei," answered Hunt. "I want to see her for myself."
And this is what she did, surprising the master at arms, who handed her a holstered pistol, which she strapped on as she clambered over the side, ignoring the throbbing in her bad leg. When Hunt dropped onto the deck of the trawler, she found that the boarding party had already placed under arrest the half-dozen crew members of the Wenrei. They sat cross-legged amidships, with an armed guard hovering behind them, their wrists bound at their backs in plastic flex cuffs, their peaked fishing caps pulled low, and their clothes oily and stained. When Hunt stepped on deck, one of the arrested men, who was oddly clean-shaven and whose cap wasn't pulled low but was worn proudly back on his head, stood. The gesture wasn't defiant, actually quite the opposite. He was clear-eyed. Hunt immediately took him for the captain of the Wenrei. The chief petty officer who was leading the party explained that they'd searched most of the trawler, but that a steel, watertight hatch secured one of the stern compartments and the crew had refused to unlock it. The chief had ordered a welding torch brought from the ship's locker. In about 15 minutes, they'd have everything opened up. The clean-shaven man, the trawler's captain, began to speak in uncertain and heavily accented English.
"Are you command here?"
"You speak English?" Hunt replied.
"Are you command here?"
he repeated to her, as if perhaps he weren't certain what these words meant and had simply memorized them long ago as a contingency.
"I am Captain Sarah Hunt, United States Navy," she answered, placing her palm on her chest. "Yes, this is my command."
He nodded, and as he did, his shoulders collapsed, as if shrugging off a heavy pack.
"I surrender my command to you."
Then he turned his back to Hunt, a gesture that, at first, seemed to be a sign of disrespect, but that she soon recognized as being something altogether different. In his open palm, which was cuffed behind him at the wrist, was a key. He'd been holding it all this time, and was now, with whatever ceremony he could muster, surrendering it to Hunt. Hunt plucked the key from his palm, which was noticeably soft, not the calloused palm of a fisherman. She approached the compartment at the stern on the Wenrei, popped off the lock, and opened the hatch.
"What we got, ma'am?"
asked the master at arms, who stood close behind her.
"Christ," said Hunt, staring at racks of blinking miniature hard drives and plasma screens. "I have no idea."
1347, March 12th, 2034. GMT plus 430. Strait of Hormuz. When Wedge switched to manual control, the Lockheed contractors on the George H.W. Bush immediately began to radio, wanting to know if everything was okay. He hadn't answered, at least not at first. They could still track him and see that he was adhering to their flight plan, which at this moment placed him approximately 50 nautical miles west of Bandar Abbas, the main regional Iranian naval base. The accuracy of his flight proved, at least to him, that his navigation was as precise as any computer. Then his F-35 hit a pocket of atmospheric turbulence, a bad one. Wedge could feel it shudder up the controls through his feet, which were planted on the rudder pedals, into the stick, and across his shoulders. The turbulence threatened to throw him off course, which could have diverted him into the more technologically advanced layers of Iranian air defenses, the ones that expanded outward from Tehran, in which the F-35's stealth countermeasures might prove inadequate. "This is it," he thought. or at least as close to it as he had ever come. His manipulation of throttle, stick, and rudder was fast, instinctual, the result of his entire career in the cockpit, and of 4 generations worth of Mitchell family breeding. He skittered his aircraft on the edge of the turbulence, flying for a total of 3.6 nautical miles at a speed of 736 knots, with his aircraft oriented with 28 degrees of yaw respective to its direction of flight. The entire episode lasted under 4 seconds, but it was a moment of hidden grace, one that only he, and perhaps his great-grandfather watching from the afterlife, appreciated in the instant of its occurrence. Then, as quickly as the turbulence sprung up, it dissipated, and Wedge was flying steadily. Once again, the Lockheed contractors on the George H.W. Bush radioed, asking why he disabled his navigation computer. They insisted that he turn it back on. "Roger," said Wedge, as he finally came up over the encrypted communications link. "Activating navigation override." He leaned forward, pressed a single innocuous button, and felt a slight lurch, like a train being switched back onto a set of tracks, as his F-35 returned to autopilot. Wedge was overcome by an urge to smoke a cigarette in the cockpit, just as Pappy Boyington used to do, but he'd pushed his luck far enough for today. Returning to the bush in a cockpit that reeked of a celebratory Marlboro would likely be more than the Lockheed contractors, or his superiors, could countenance. The pack was in the left breast pocket of his flight suit, but he'd wait and have one on the fantail after his debrief. Checking his watch, he calculated that he'd be back in time for dinner in the pilot's dirty shirt wardroom in the forward part of the carrier. He hoped they'd have the heart attack sliders he loved, triple cheeseburger patties with a fried egg on top. It was while he was thinking of that dinner and the cigarette that his F-35 diverted off course, heading north, inland toward Iran. This shift in direction was so smooth that Wedge didn't even notice it until another series of calls came from the bush, all of them alarmed as to this change in heading. "Turn on your navigation computer." Wedge tapped at its screen. "My navigation computer is on. Wait, I'm going to reboot." Before Wedge could begin the long reboot sequence, he realized that his computer was non-responsive. "Avionics are out. I'm switching to manual override." He pulled at his stick. He stamped on his rudder pedals. The throttle no longer controlled the engine. His F-35 was beginning to lose altitude, descending gradually. In sheer frustration, a frustration that bordered on rage, he tugged at the controls, strangling them, as if he were trying to murder the plane in which he flew. He could hear the chatter in his helmet, the impotent commands from the George H.W. Bush, which weren't even really commands, but rather pleadings, desperate requests for Wedge to figure out this problem. But he couldn't. Wedge didn't know who or what was flying his plane.